Hey, good evening, everyone. Last time I was here, I was asked to give a talk about the Tree Ratna Buddhist movement being radical, using the example of Dr. Ambedkar. And this time I've come back and I've asked to give a talk on how Tree Ratna is revolutionary. And I've asked to do that by using Dr. Ambedkar as an example. So there's a bit of a theme developing here. It's not that I think of myself as particularly radical or revolutionary, but I'm very pleased to be asked to come back and talk about Dr. Ambedkar. Actually, funnily enough, Vadika and I are both doing a retreat together at Astana at the end of June, using some of his work on looking at capitalism and some of the work of Dr. Ambedkar. So if you're interested in this theme and you've been to both his talks, or it might be a good idea to come on that retreat at Astana. Anyway, so it's not that I'm a great expert in Dr. Ambedkar, but I'm very happy to do talks about him and to look at his work more closely, because I think we need something more of his spirit, more of that kind of revolutionary spirit in the Dharma in the West and Buddhism in the West. And I think India has always sort of fascinated me. The example of Buddhism in India, which I'll talk about in a minute, it's always fascinated me because I think Indian Buddhism, modern Indian Buddhism, offers us a vision of what is possible in the world, that we get a sort of separation of the West and the East, and Western Buddhism and Eastern Buddhism. I'd like to see less of that in the future. I'd like to see more intermingling of sanghas, and a dialogue about us as modern Buddhists in the modern globalised culture, and less about Easterners and Westerners. And I do have that vision. I do have that vision that the Tree Ratna Buddhist order is one order, and I spend quite a proportion of my time putting myself behind that vision of one order, not as an order of Indians over in India and Westerners in the West. And one of the things that I do is that I'm a trustee of a charity called the India Dharma Trust, which raises money for the Dharma revolution in India, particularly ordination training in India. And sometimes, you know, that can be quite difficult. I've got quite a lot to do anyway, and sometimes I think, you know, is this the best use of my time? And I was having those kind of feelings when I was on a convention in India, so an order convention in India, when I went to it. And actually, the order convention in India is a truly wonderful and amazing thing to happen, because one of the things that I noticed was that people from the UK were in a minority, which was quite an experience for someone from the UK, who's sort of used to being the centre of everything. But no, we were in the minority. And we were in this sangha of people that truly were international, and not just because we were all from different nations, but we were all sort of practicing Buddhists. It was something much more than that. We created an atmosphere together that was more than the sum of its parts, and there was a kind of deep resonance between all the order at Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha was enlightened. Something that some of you may have felt if you'd been on a recent pilgrimage, that it's not just because we're kind of doing the same meditation practices or something. It's because we have that same vision. And when people with the same vision come together from different cultures, something that is created. So I lost all my doubts about being a trustee of the India Dharma Trust. And I was just very much enjoying being at Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha got enlightened. And we had this convention that had, I think it was about 400 or 500 people there. And it was wonderful. Every morning we'd process to the Mahabodhi temple, and we were asked to wear blue. So there was this kind of ragtail bunch of people wearing different shades of blue, winding its way through the streets of Bodh Gaya. You know, all people of all different cultures, and Indians and Westerners, and it was early in the morning, and it's just a very, very beautiful sight. And I do love our order. I love our order because they weren't quite wearing blue. They were nearly wearing blue. And you know, they were meant to be silent, but people were talking a little bit. And but there was just such an atmosphere of sort of friendliness and sort of togetherness. I really, really enjoyed it. So when the order convention finished, there was a Mitra convention. So we just heard about Mitra ceremonies, but we have Mitras over in India. Only the difference is when you have a Mitra convention in India, 2,000 people turn up. So I thought, I just really wanted to see it. I just really wanted to see 2,000 Mitras in a marquee. So I stayed on in a slightly nosy sort of a way. And I stayed on after the order convention. And one day, I went to sit underneath the Bodhi tree at the Mahabodhi temple. And I saw something quite extraordinary. I saw this young man in front of me, and he couldn't have been more than 18, I think. He was dressed in very, very simple clothes. He looked very clean and sort of upright young man. And but, you know, he was obviously didn't have a huge amount of money. But he was sitting in meditation, and he was absolutely still. So when I arrived at the Bodhi tree, he was sitting there, and he was still. And I thought, this young man has got something. I don't know what it is, but he's got something. There was such a kind of atmosphere around him of simplicity and purity and dedication. And it's also quite unusual to see a young man of that age quite so still, I think. But there he was, and he was sitting there, and he just looked incredibly beautiful. So not in a kind of handsome way necessarily, but more in a sense of there was such a sense of grace and dignity about his being that I was mesmerised. I truly was mesmerised. And I sat behind him to meditate, but it was almost like there were these kind of waves of, I don't know, some feeling coming off this young man. And I thought, this is really extraordinary. And I couldn't quite, you know, I was getting into my meditation, but there was always his presence was very, very real in front of me. And after an hour of sitting there, I got up. And shortly after I got up, he got up and he turned around, and he was wearing this sort of badge thing around his neck. And I realised that he was one of our Mitras, and I was so proud. I felt like his mother, actually, but you know, I don't know who he was. But I was so proud. I was so proud that Buddhism could create, you know, could bring about such a fine being. And that he was part of our movement, and that somehow he was my brother. I really did feel like that. And I thought, well, of course it's worthwhile. Of course it's worthwhile trying so hard to raise money for the order in India. So I just wanted to give that as a sort of image to start, because we're talking about the Dharma Revolution. But when I think of the Dharma Revolution, that's who I think of. That's my vision for a revolution. It's not about people carrying banners or shouting at other people in the street or anything like that. It's not about harsh, angry men. It's about this young man with complete dignity who could have an effect on me, even though I never uttered a single word to him. I don't even know if he spoke the same language. So, yes, that's what the Dharma Revolution is to me. And we might ask ourselves, well, do we need a revolution at all? Is a revolution necessary? So I just wanted to go and unpack that about why we might need a revolution. So the desire for revolution starts with a deep satisfaction about the world, about the way things are in the world. And it comes from a sense that we don't want to just tinker around the edges, you know, just a sort of subtle way to make people have a more comfortable life. It starts with a sense of the desire for real transformation of the individual and real transformation of the world. And this is the way the Buddha talked about it, although he didn't use the word revolution. But he had a vision of the world as on fire. He said, the world is on fire, burning with the fires of greed, hatred and delusion. And in a sense, you could say, well, is that just fear-mongering? Is that sort of Old Testament preachers banging on about a vision of hell? But actually, I think it's more from the Buddha, it comes more from his personal experience, and it comes from a sense of compassion. So when the Buddha talked about it, he said that when he, before he was enlightened, he had a sort of vision of being struggling like fish in water too shallow, each in competition with each other, each in arguments and disagreements and conflict with one another. And he said that when he saw that, he was afraid. He trembled. He shook with fear. And he said that he had a vision at that point that beings were running around like this because they had a thorn stuck deep in the heart. And he said that that thorn can be taken out. So in a sense, from that description of his vision of the world, we can get an idea that it wasn't just a kind of trying to bang on about you're all going to go to hell, or you know, you're all going to burn or something like that. It's a sense that the Buddha had that we could be so much more. That in a way there's a vision that beings are suffering and they need not suffer. That the thorn can be removed from their heart. So the vision of a need for evolution comes not from fear, but from love. It's a profoundly optimistic vision. It's an optimistic vision that says we could all be enlightened, no matter who you are, what background you come from, what gender you are, you know, what you've done with your life, whoever you've been, you also can be enlightened. The thorn can be removed from your heart. And interestingly, at that point, the Buddha didn't say anything about what the thorn actually was. You know, later Buddhism, of course, made lists about what the thorn is. But in that first kind of poem, if you like, or song of the Buddha, cry of the Buddha, he doesn't say what the thorn is. He just says it can be removed. So that's something we can talk about in our groups. Do we need a revolution? And in a way, what kind of revolution do we need? So often we see revolution in terms of a political revolution or an economic revolution or a social revolution. But the greatest revolutionary sees the real problem, sees the heart of the problem. And the heart of the problem is the divided mind. In the Yogacara, it's called the defiled mind consciousness. And the defiled mind consciousness sees an external world as out there and sees our internal world as an ego self and seeks to protect the self against the world or appropriate the world for itself. So this is the real problem. It's the divided consciousness, the dualistic outlook that seeks to be in opposition or to appropriate other. And this is what the great revolutionary Dr. Ambedkar saw. This is what he saw as the root of the problem and the reason that we need a revolution. So he had a situation in India where he was born into the caste system, and in that caste system he was regarded as an untouchable. So some of you might know about the caste system in India. I do know you also had some Indian Dharmacharinis with you recently, and they probably told you quite a lot about Indian Buddhism and the situation in India. But yes, so here we have Dr. Ambedkar, and he was presented with a divided India. A divided India based on what he called graded inequality, which was the separation of people into castes, in which you're born and you can't leave. You know, there's nothing you can do by which you can move up a caste or something like that. If you're born into the untouchable caste, you are just untouchable by anyone of a higher caste than you. And there's no way you can change that. You just have to live in suffering and just suffer it out. So some of you might know about the caste system because of recent stories coming from India or the atrocities that happen in India due to the caste system, where it's quite legitimate for someone in the higher caste to abuse and commit acts of violence against someone from a lower caste. But really, it's not the kind of outrageous things that are the worst thing about the caste system. The things about the caste system that are worse are the everyday oppressions of being denied access to education, knowledge and land, of being denied a way out, being denied an opportunity to create wealth for your family, for example. You're stuck, and everything that your family's had to do, the torments that they've suffered, you've just got to suffer that too, because that's how you're born. So that's what the system that Dr. Ambedkar was born into. And he, for various reasons, which I won't go into now, but he did get access to education. And he really longed for freedom for his people. But he knew that the freedom had to consist in a freedom from mental attitude. He saw that the deep-seated problem of caste was a stain in consciousness. It was about an attitude of mind. It wasn't really about a social or economic problem. It was a problem of mind. So I think, you know, when we talk about the caste system in India, it's sort of very easy to think, wow, that's just really awful and it could never happen here sort of thing. But actually, I think it's not just about India. Because I think even though we don't have the caste system in the UK, we do have the divided mind. We do have that divided consciousness, the defiled mind consciousness. And that's just as present here as it is anywhere, particularly now. You can see it particularly when it comes to fear of other. I think that's how it manifests, fear of other, fear of immigration, fear of people from different ethnic groups with different beliefs and ways of being. I was even going to say the fear of Tories. Because I was just saying to... this might not go down very well in Sheffield, but we do in fact have a Tory MP who's a Mitra in the Tree Ratna Buddhist community. He's a very dear friend of mine. And... she was saying to me, she said, well, it's interesting because, you know, the Tree Ratna Buddhist community talks about diversity, and it wants diversity, but it wants liberal diversity. And I thought, well, you know, she is right. And there's a hell of a lot of conditioning, you know, that I come with about Tories, which I just had to sort of, you know, work with, which was very good for me. But I did think about that. I think she's right. Anyway, I had this a group with her, and also someone who was discussing about whether she should be a hunt saboteur as well, an anarchist hunt saboteur. And I thought, this is brilliant. This is just brilliant. Like, where else could you have a hunt saboteur and a Tory MP in the same discussion group? With me in the middle, looking incredibly tense. So yes, the divided mind comes up in many ways. Anyway, so yes, so the problem he saw was this problem of the divided mind, of the attitude in which the mind that can make caste possible. And he tried all sorts of methods. He tried all sorts of methods in his life to undermine the caste system and gain freedom for his people. He tried politics. He actually drafted the Constitution of India. He tried economic solutions. I haven't got my notes of how many PhDs he did, but he definitely did a few PhDs and about economics, and wrote quite a lot about the economic inequalities set up by the British government, in fact, that were keeping Indian poor and that were... the economic system was all focused around basically the wealth of Britain. So he tried economic solutions. He tried social action. And none of it was enough. None of it was enough. He said he drafted the constitution, and at one point he said it's like a palace built on a dung heap. You can have this wonderful palace, but if the mind is a dung heap, then nothing good can happen. And he became quite disillusioned, actually. And it was in his, you can read it, it's online, in his great, very famous essay, which he was going to give as a speech, but then they wouldn't let him say it. But he wrote it as a paper, which is called Annihilation of Caste. And he said in that, that really it's about the reform of the mind, a change in mind and soul that's going to get rid of caste. It's not going to be just politics, economics or social action. He said that caste is a mental construction, and it's that mental construction that we've got to change. And he said, my battle is not a battle for wealth and power, but for freedom and self-respect. So when I was asked to give this talk, I was asked to give a kind of a summary of how he did it, how he saw that freedom was possible, how he envisaged the revolution. What was his recipe? That's what I was asked. What was his recipe? So as far as I can tell, and this is just me sort of searching through some of his works, I think there's three factors that Dr. Ambedkar talked about as being very important for a revolution. Education, self-responsibility and religion. So I'll just go through those. He said that in terms of education, he said, I've always held that knowledge is power in every field of life. And the scheduled castes will not attain their goal of freedom and liberty until they drink deep of all knowledge. It's a very beautiful phrase, that, drink deep of all knowledge. And he asked people to use their money for the education of their children. Educate your children. And many families did that. They put all their money into education for their children at the expense of food, clothing and housing situations for their family. Everything went into education. Because for Dr. Ambedkar and his people, education is not just about a piece of paper. It's a tool for uplift. It's the means of moral and social transformation. Because education makes you into someone. It makes you capable. It makes you interesting to talk to and interested in the world. It makes you confident. It makes you trustworthy. It gives you a sense of power and potency when you can walk in the world with something to say of yourself. It means, for him, it means that you can look the Brahmin in the eye. And I've seen this actually in India where I went on a youth convention there, and the young women from Maharashtra, where Dr. Ambedkar was from and who have been practicing Buddhism for a few generations now, the young girls were really confident and outgoing, had no problem about getting that microphone and telling all the world, including Lord Buddha TV, which was filming the whole event, exactly what they thought about everything. But the young girls from Bihar, from northern India, who hadn't had that kind of Buddhist education in their lives, couldn't even look me in the face. And I was trying to engage with them. But they couldn't even look up. They were so shy, you know, so kind of in their own world. And I thought, it's education that means that you can look people in the eye and think you might have something to say. And you take that into your interactions with society. So one of the kind of slogans Dr. Ambedkar had was educate, agitate and organise. Well, education has to come first, because you need to know what you can do. You need to know what can be possible. You've got to believe you can make a change, and you've got to go about achieving that change. But within that is self-responsibility, because of course education isn't enough. Education isn't enough, because he said it's a bit like having, education is like a sword, but if you put the sword in the wrong hands, it'll just become dangerous. That's right. Yeah. And actually, you can see this in Dr. Ambedkar's personal life. The sense that I get of his own personal life was, he's someone who had a marvellous education. He really, really worked hard. He got degrees in the US and in the UK as well. And he saw that he had this kind of power, in a sense. He said of himself, and I think it's true, he was the most educated man in India at that time. But he saw also that it wasn't, he had this power, but it wasn't a good thing to just be angry at people. You know, he could have used that education to really take out some aggression on people, and he had every justification for doing that. You know, he'd been treated so badly in his life. He had a lot to be angry about, but he fought very, very hard within himself to treat his opponents with honour and respect. And he did that. He treated his opponents with honour and respect. And he wouldn't make any of his movements. He was offered actually quite a lot of money and support at one time if he would say that no Brahmin was allowed in his political organisation. And he refused that money. He said, no, that's not what it's about. It's not about that. He actually saw that you need to be an upright person. Who treats everyone with honour and respect. Otherwise, you're just basically becoming the monster that you're fighting. So he encouraged in his people a level of self-responsibility. And there's a beautiful speech, actually, where he recollected the Parinibbana Sutta, which is the discourse of the last days of the Buddha. And he paraphrased the last teaching of the Buddha to be, be self-illuminating like the sun. Don't be dependent for light like the earth. Believe in yourself. Don't be dependent on another. Be truthful. Always take refuge in the truth and don't surrender to anybody. And I find this very, very moving, actually, because these are people who've been oppressed for generations upon generations and generations. He was saying, believe in yourself. Don't be dependent on other people. Be like the sun. And it has quite a lot of parallels in Sangharakshita's teachings on becoming an individual. So Sangharakshita talks about the need to become what he calls a true individual, who is creative, emotionally positive and aware. And recently someone went to ask Sangharakshita, he said, well, is that a good teaching for us in the West? Because we tend to be quite individualistic. We tend to be a bit sort of me before anyone else. And we don't tend to think in terms of society as much as other cultures. Of course, South Yorkshire excluded. I think there's quite a lot of resonance with South Yorkshire and the Indians. I think we should all get together with Indians because I think, you know, we'd all get on really well. Not that I'm from South Yorkshire, actually. I'm from Tooting. But anyway, I'm an honorary Yorkshire woman, apparently. Good, okay, what was that? Oh, yes. So someone went to see Bhatti about everyone outside of South Yorkshire being individualistic. And he said, and they said, you know, do you think the teaching of the true individual is helpful for us in our culture? And he said, oh, you know, I can see your point. I think the emphasis has to be on ethical responsibility. So that's quite interesting. I do think that the point about being ethically responsible, responsible for your own actions, not having an attitude that anyone's forced you into anything, not being a kind of victim in your own life, but taking full responsibility for who you are, what you say, what you do, and apologising if necessary. So it's not about being individualistic as opposed to society. There's actually a word for it, one of the words for this kind of quality, which I quite like in the Pali scriptures, which is shilava, which means a kind of being of ethics, which or uprightness, upright moral character. I really like that. I think we should all be shilavas, sort of upright moral kind of characters, trustworthy, noble people, the sons or daughters of the Buddha. So why is this necessary for a revolution? Well, Dr. Ambedkar answered this when he said, don't be under the illusion someone will come and emancipate you. Emancipate yourself. Because he saw that if we have the attitude of being a victim, we're stuck. So there's a very strong things he said to his own followers. I mean, they had enormous faith and respect to Dr. Ambedkar, so he could pretty much say anything. But it's very interesting what he did say. It actually goes on more than this, but I'm not going to read the whole thing to you. He said, "My heart breaks to see the pitiable sight of your faces and to hear your sad voices. You have been groaning from time immemorial, and yet you are not ashamed to hug to your helplessness as an inevitability. As a matter of fact, it is your birthright to get food, shelter, and clothing in this land in equal proportion with every individual, high or low. If you believe in living a respectable life, you believe in self-help, which is the best help." And when I read that, I thought, oh, how much do we hug our helplessness as an inevitability? Because there's always a reason why we can't do it. You know, it's because there's some special fact about us that makes us uniquely unable to live the spiritual life. And we turn over that excuse, our own special brand of helplessness that we hug close to us. Because basically it means we don't have to change. And I remember actually when I was Mitch Convener here, and for some reason a sort of stream of people came in and they all said to me, "Well, you know, I can't do it. I can't be a Buddhist because, what was it?" So one of them was because I'm a bit too posh for everyone around here. And then it was a bit, "I'm too working class for everyone around here." Or, "I'm too alternative for the people around here." Or, "I'm too old." Or, "I'm too young." Or, "I'm a woman." Or, "I'm a man." And I just thought, this is unbelievable. What is going on? It's got nothing to do with whether you should be in the Sangha or not. It's got to do with mind. It's got to do with the mind that says, "I can't do it," for my own special brand of helplessness. So these are people who are, you know, really have been oppressed. Oppressed in a way that I don't think I will ever understand. Particularly women, actually. But he said to you people, get rid of that attitude. If you have that attitude, if you hug your helplessness, you won't be liberated. And you'll lead a little life. And he said to the women, and there's great speeches, he was a great advocate of women's rights, Dr. Ambedkar. In fact, if I had the time, that's one of the books I'd like to write, is about Dr. Ambedkar's teachings on the rights for women, because he was a great advocate of women's rights. And there's these wonderful speeches that he made to women. And basically, he said, you've got to teach your children that they are destined to be great. So these are people who've been told that they're worthless. They're not even worth the touch of another human being. They're not even allowed to share the same water source as another human being because they're worse than dogs. Sometimes they were called like that. And he said, teach your children, they are destined to be great. And he said, if you believe you're great, you are great, you will become great. He said, we are not slaves, we are a warrior clan. Nothing is more disgraceful for a brave man than to live a life devoid of self-respect. Better to die in the prime of youth for a great cause than to live like an oak and do nothing. And he said, believe in your own strength. So he saw that mental attitudes had to change in society, but he saw that that change in mental attitude has to start with ourselves. It's no good other people telling us great if we're great unless we believe it ourselves. And actually, you do get that impression with our brothers and sisters in the order in India. They are great people. I believe in their greatness, but it doesn't matter whether I believe in their greatness or not. They believe in their greatness. And they are great. And they do have that sense. I've got many friends in India who do have that sense. I think actually, you know, the Indian Dharmacharanis who came recently. They would rather die than live an impoverished life. Impoverished mentally, not about how much wealth you have. But they have a belief that it is better to live a short life of greatness than a long life of servitude. And they are ready to stick by that. They really are. So yes, so part of it is about self-responsibility, believing we're great. But he also was a man, Dr. Ambedkar, of deep religious feeling. And he said he thought of his battle, the battle that he was fighting against caste as a spiritual battle. And he considered religion to be essential to society. He was quite struck that he often talks actually about that comment that Marx made about religion being the opiate of the people. And he says it's really not an opiate to the people. He said, whatever good things I have in me, or whatever have been the benefits of my education to society, I owe them to the religious feelings in me. And he obviously did have that deep, deep religious feeling. So it's quite interesting for us to reflect on this, because since the Reformation in Europe, we tend to see religion as a private matter. So religion is something that we do in our own homes and shouldn't be inflicted on anyone else. There's religion, which is in our own homes, and our private thing that one mustn't really talk about. And then there's society, which is a different thing over there, and never the twain shall meet. But Dr. Ambedkar had a very, very different idea than this. He said that that government can't really govern behaviour. Only religion can govern behaviour, because religion determines mental attitudes, which determine behaviour itself. So you can have laws, but people are going to break those laws. I mean, you can't completely enforce the whole population. It won't really change people's inner drives. The only thing that will change people's sort of deep-seated mental attitudes and ensure a just society is religion itself. And he saw the negative side of this with Hinduism. He saw that you can outlaw it, you can make laws to stop the caste system which are in place, that he put in place in India. He was the first law minister of the new government after independence. So you can outlaw caste, but if people believe in it, they're going to practice it anyway, which you see actually in India still now. You know, so this is a sort of classic, is if a Dalit family or a family from the scheduled caste decides to, they're going to buy some land for themselves and better their family's wealth, the highest caste will usually rape and murder the daughters. That's the absolute classic thing to stop the family progressing. You can outlaw that kind of thing. It's illegal, but it happens because people still have that deep-seated attitude of caste, which is you can't grow. The society is divided, and we mustn't let those people over there grow. And there's no real motivation to change. So in the end, your law can do whatever it likes, but actually it's the attitudes that make the difference. And in fact, he did the reason he left politics is he drafted something called the Hindu Code Bill to outlaw some of the really sort of vicious aspects of the treatment of women, particularly in India. And the government refused to pass it. They just said, you know, this is our ancient law, and we won't change it. So it was against their religion. And they've got religious rights, so they wouldn't pass the Hindu Code Bill, which is a great shame, actually. Anyway, so yes, it's religion that he thought that shapes the mind and dictates the duties and behaviour patterns of the individual. And this really reflects, again, Sangharakshita's teachings. He said, religion is the most important thing. It's the matter of what you most truly and deeply believe. It's the matter for which you will be willing to die. So this is also a very different view than is current in society at the moment. I remember someone putting on Facebook this sort of billboard outside a cafe that says, it doesn't matter what you believe, it's what you do. But actually, what you do is an expression of what you believe. So it is very important what you believe. That's the summary of this particular point. What you believe shapes your behaviour, which shapes your society. So he said that we need a belief system, we need a religious system that has a radical notion of what duty is, that has a duty to society as one, not a divided society. And he also said that religion must change society. Religion must be something that aids the betterment of society. And to do that, religion must be a religion that helps personal development and self-responsibility. So he said, religion must be a matter of principles only. It cannot be a matter of rules. The moment it degenerates into rules, it ceases to be religion, as it kills responsibility, which is the essence of every truly religious act. I really, really like this quote because I really like the idea that responsibility is the essence of every truly religious act. I think there's a lot to reflect on in there. It means that every choice we make, if we take responsibility for our actions, we're undertaking a religious act. Buddhism isn't just about sort of meditating on a cushion or even coming to Sangha night. It's about every action we undertake in the world and whether we're taking responsibility for our actions or not. It's not about kind of blindly following some rules that someone else has made up. And he said that the transformation that religion gives us is about metta. So he talked quite a lot about metta or maitri as it is in Sanskrit. And he said it's that quality of maitri which is at the root of democracy and the functioning of society is dependent on metta. So we need metta in the world. Without metta, without maitri, we cannot have a functioning society. You can have all the rules you like, you can have all the political system you like, but without maitri as the foundation of society, it will not be a just society. And he also recognised that the mind of metta is hard to cultivate, and it takes dedication and time. So he saw the need for a sangha, and he had quite a lot to say about what the sangha should consist of, or who the sangha should be. And he envisaged the sangha as a model for others, because it's the sangha that can exemplify Buddhist practice and can exemplify metta in action. You know, developing the mind in metta is hard. We've all sort of had that experience of doing the metta bhavana. And it's not always easy. You know, so he said, well, you need some people who are really, really dedicated to cultivating that mind of metta to serve as a model for other people. And also he said that the sangha should offer guidance, not just in a kind of, like, a sort of special breed of counsellors or intellectuals who can just sort of dole out sort of different Buddhist teachings, but actually people who've really reflected on the Dharma, on the way things are, who've really put metta into action in their lives and who can serve other beings, who can serve others and give them guidance. But I think also kind of giving that, so there's a social role for religion because it gives us a sense of morality and it gives us the foundation of metta in society, the way, a means to cultivate metta in society. But in a way it can make religion sound a bit like it's just a tool for society, and it's more than that. So Dr. Ambedkar also had a very deep sense of the potential of enlightenment which lies within all beings. So just to put it in context for the scheduled caste, it's written in Hindu law that if someone from that caste hears the words of the Vedas, so hears the religious law, they should have molten lead poured in their ears. So they are denied access to any religious kind of ceremonies or functionings or entrance into the temples or anything like that. But he saw that all beings can gain enlightenment. All beings can progress spiritually. And it doesn't matter whether you're literate or not or what kind of background, as I said. He really saw that potential for all beings. And he said that religion is necessary because we need a vision of prajna, of wisdom, shila, of ethics, karuna, of compassion, and maitri, or loving kindness. And he said it's possible to reach perfection. So I think that's true of us. I think if we really want a revolution in society, we need to believe that there are some higher values. that there is a possibility of developing wisdom and compassion, of having a truly ethical system, and to develop metta or maitri. Because if we don't have that vision of what's possible, if we don't have that kind of vision of higher values, then we're going to waste our life, basically. We're going to waste our life in getting and spending. And it was a bit like, well, you know, so he could help with the uplift of his people, but then what? What? So then they just become middle-class Indians. His vision didn't stop there. His vision was a vision of radical transformation, where people could realise limitless wisdom, limitless compassion, and limitless energy. So, yes, given all of that, it's unsurprising that he turned to Buddhism and converted to Buddhism with many thousands, millions of his followers. Because Buddhism is a revolution. He called it the revolution. He said it was a revolution just as much as the French Revolution was a revolution. And it's a revolution because it has this transformation of the divided consciousness into a mind of metta. And it's a revolution because it contains within it the making of a shilava, of an upright ethical person. It's the means to creation of ethically upright and responsible human beings. And it allows the transformation of society through sangha. And he said that he was confident that not only India, but the whole world will embrace Buddhism. So I was thinking about this and how this relates to Sangharakshita's teachings. There's a very, very good talk that Sangharakshita gave called Enlightenment is Experience and Non-Experience. And he says in that the best way to think of the spiritual path is to think of it in terms of work, growth and duty, which are not very popular words, but I really like that. It's so much better than sort of Eastern mysticism or something. Anyway, so he talked about work not just as wage slavery, but productive expenditure of energy. And so when I think about work in the spiritual life, what I think about is Dr. Ambedkar's phrase about drinking deeply from knowledge and educating ourselves in the Dharma. And so what we can take from this is that we have so much on offer, particularly looking around at Sheffield Buddhist Centre and the notice board and the programme. We have so much on offer here. So if we really want the Dharma revolution, it's not about going through the streets of Sheffield carrying placards. It's about drinking deeply from what you have. Drink deeply from what you're offered at the Buddhist Centre. There's a whole library there. Drink deeply from the Dharma itself. Really work, really kind of put that into practice. Really find out what it's all about. So that would be the first thing that I would recommend, is work. Education is work. And the other thing he talked about was growth. The central image of Buddhism is about growth. The central image of Buddhism is about, for example, the lotus. And if we drink deeply from the Dharma, we will grow. We will grow like plants or like lotuses. There's a beautiful description in the scriptures where it says that the Dharma is like the rain that falls on everyone. If we drink deeply from that rain, then we will all grow in our own way. So part of that is about becoming an individual, an ethically responsible, aware individual, creating in ourselves a substantial human being that can act responsibly in the world, and that can see, when we can see ourselves as part of society, becoming a shilava. And the third thing that he talked about is duty. So duty, again, is not a very popular word. I think generally in the West, we value ideas like freedom rather than duty. Duty seems to us sort of oppressive and dry. But actually, I don't think freedom is always a good idea, because the problem is with freedom is we have so much freedom in this culture that it comes at the expense of contentment. We have so much on offer that sometimes we don't know what to do. Sometimes we just think about our lives and just think, well, there's so much I could do. What do I do? And it paralyzes us because we're kind of constantly told, well, just do what you feel like. But that's not really a way to live. Just do what you feel like. So we get kind of paralyzed by our own choice. So I think when Sangharaksha is talking about duty, he's talking really about service to our higher ideals. And he actually says about duties that they are sweetly laid upon us by the voice of our potential Buddhahood reverberating within. So we can think about our kind of duties, quite like that, the choir of angels whispering to us of our duties. It's not a kind of headmistress telling you what to do. It's a sweetly laid upon us by the voice of our potential Buddhahood reverberating within. I think basically what it means is that as we become self-responsible and ethically aware, we realise that we're part of society. And if we're part of society, we have an effect on society. And it's just acting in accordance with that. Not just thinking about what we want to do, but what is best for society itself. Just for the very simple reason that we're part of society. What we do affects society. And what society is like affects us. Sangharaksha talks about the kind of Buddhist revolution. He said if we want a revolution, we have to start with what he called the nucleus of this new society. We have to have that vision of Sangha, in a sense, that Dr. Ambedkar had, the way you've got a nucleus of people who are ethically upright and aware and who can act responsibly in the world and offer guidance to others. We need a nucleus of people who are cultivating metta, cultivating Maitri, as the foundation of a just society. And if we have those people working together, they can do incredible things. If those Shilavas, if you like, get together and work together with minds of metta, cultivating metta, then that itself can transform society. And that indeed is what we've seen in India, groups of order members and mitras getting together and doing amazing things. And this is the vision that Dr. Ambedkar had. He talked about the Prabuddha Bharat, which means the kind of Buddhist pure land that he was hopeful for in India. He thought that if it started in India, it might spread to the whole world. And he said that we needed to reflect on our duties as Buddhists. He said, the duty of a Buddhist is not merely to be a good Buddhist. His duty is to spread Buddhism. They must believe that to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind. So this is a very, very different attitude than religion should be just kept private. He said that Buddhism, to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind. And maybe you've got a sense about why that might be the case. So really we can take from the revolution in India that the revolution has to be a matter of transformation in the inside. It has to start with a change in attitude, starting with ourselves and our own change in attitude towards ourselves, changing attitudes in society. And to transform that mental attitude, we need work or education. We need to become self-responsible, creative individuals. We need to grow spiritually. And we need to be able to act to benefit society. We need to be this kind of nucleus of a new society founded on metta and self-responsibility and ethics. A bit too much. I might just say a little bit about this because I was also asked what we can learn from our Indian brothers and sisters. So I did ask one of our Indian brothers about what we can learn from our Indian brothers and sisters, and he told me in quite some length what we as Westerners can learn from our Indian brothers and sisters. So he spent quite a lot of time in the UK, and he said, well, first of all, he said our commitment to education. He said, well, he's seen that in the West we don't take our education seriously. He said, you know, but in India, education is a moral act. It's a moral issue. It's not just about being told to go to school when you didn't want to go to school. He said it comes with a vision of Baba Saheb, which is Dr. Ambedkar. And I remember he visited my family and looked around our living room, which my parents are journalists, so there's a lot of books in our house. And he was quiet for some time, and he said, "Vajratar, if I was born in your condition, I would have written 3 books by now." And I said to him, "No, you wouldn't. If you were born in my conditions, you would have been smoking cigarettes around the back of the bike shed and bunking school like the rest of us." So I think one of the things we've got to do is we've got to use what we have, use our resources for transformation, not undermining what we have. And the other thing that he pointed out is that because we see religion as a very separate matter from society, we've divorced it from the state, if you like, religion from the state, but we've also divorced it from culture. So in India, there's much more of an effort made in cultivating a Buddhist culture with music and rituals and myths, legends, stories, public kind of events. And it's interesting that Dr. Ambedkar said there's one question which every religion must answer. What mental and moral relief does it bring to the suppressed and downtrodden? And I was reflecting on the phrase moral and mental relief, because relief isn't just about a social change. It's also about joy and the joy of culture. So I was talking about my new friend. I went to visit his family, and I met his father. His father's a wonderful man. He's also a Buddhist. And he really took Dr. Ambedkar's message to heart and put all his money really in his son's education. So he's got 4 sons. One of them is a lecturer at Hyderabad University. One of them is a lecturer in geography. The other one's an environmental scientist, and the other one's a doctor. So they've all done very, very well for themselves. But I think that was a great cost to him and his wife, who really had to work hard to give money for the education of their children. And he said to me, "You know, I've had a hard life, but whenever I play music, I know it's going to be okay." And he asked me if I played any music, which I'm ashamed to say I don't. But he played the flute, the Indian flute. And every week he'd go off to a group where they'd sing songs in devotion to the Buddha and Baba Saheb Ambedkar. And I thought, "Oh, that's great, isn't it?" Every week they'd just go to their kind of music group and just sing. And all the tension, all the hard work that he'd done, he would feel that relief through music, actually. And I think we can be quite cautious about this kind of thing, because I can't really imagine us having a sort of music group where we'd make up songs in devotion to Sangharakshita. It just wouldn't quite work in this culture. But I think we are starting to take on that spirit. So I know that there's been a lot of work in Sheffield with the music group, and that's a great thing. I think we need more of that developed sort of joy in the culture of Buddhism. And not to be frightened of that, not to feel like, you know, "Oh, it's not very cool," or, you know, "Can we just keep it a bit private because we don't want to sort of spread our thing around." But actually to just take a lot of joy in public expressions of what we believe and what we think. In fact, in Buddhism, in India, they've got a whole thing of the Buddha Festival, which is a celebration of the Buddhist arts. And it's really great, actually. Every year they have this big festival of the Buddhist arts, and they have very, very well-known musicians coming. The other thing he said is that Westerners tend to come from their head to their heart, whereas the Indians come from their heart to their head. And there is an advantage from moving from your heart to head, which is the heart is where things happen. So there's a lot of faith in India as an intuitive response that's not tied up with too much thinking. I think what we do is we sort of bring in the planning department too early, and then we stop anything actually happening. So there's great stories in India about totally spontaneous action for the benefit of others. Sort of people, you know, I've heard about people going on a weekend retreat, for example. One man going on a weekend retreat. He used to be an alcoholic and denied his daughters any education. He went on a weekend retreat, came back, came completely off alcohol, and sent all his 5 daughters to get a proper education and started to work really hard as a rickshaw driver to pay for it. So there's stories like that where overnight people just change and they overcome difficulties. So I actually got a text from my friend today with more advice about what we can learn from our new problems. And one of them was to overcome difficulties, that they can do that because they're coming from the heart. So don't be frightened to just come from the heart and just break through obstacles, because it is possible. It is possible to just work hard, actually. Despite lack of resources, amazing things have happened in India. And I think that's the main message. The main message of Indian Buddhism is to say that change is possible by spiritual means. There's been so much achieved in one generation, and I really do recommend that if you haven't been to India and met our movement in India, that you do go on the next pilgrimage, because so much can happen, and that's so inspiring. It's not enough to talk. It's not enough to even think. We must actually see changes. We must activate ourselves. We must act in the world and change the society around us. So I think that's the real message of the Indian Buddhists. Change is possible, and it's possible by spiritual means.